Angel would have met his spouse. He would have started a family. He would have a job and a career. He would have settled in, living our American dream, and that's all gone. That's all gone because of this wrongful conviction.
In the modern history of the Illinois death penalty, which began in 1977 and ended when the penalty was abolished in 2011, 298 men and women were sentenced to death row. Of those, 20 have been exonerated. That is an extraordinarily high rate of 6.7%. This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Even though the problem of wrongful conviction led to the abolishment of the Illinois death penalty, our guests today tell us that the problem of wrongful conviction still persists.
I'm John Hanlon. I'm the former, just recently retired, executive director of the Illinois Innocence Project.
I'm Steve Beckett. So I have two hats. I'm a retired University of Illinois College of Law faculty member, but I'm a lawyer also in private practice and have continuously been in private practice since 1973. With primary focus on criminal law.
You're involved with the Innocence Project, and I think that generally people have a concept of what that is, but maybe not in any detail. If you can give me a brief overview, either of you, of what the Innocence Project is and what you do, that would be great.
Well, the Illinois Innocence Project, and I'm going to use that term because the words Innocence Project are trademarked to the large outfit in New York. So the entity that I worked for as the director and that I still work for as a lawyer is the Illinois Innocence Project. And, you know, innocence projects in general, including ours, have several different components of their mission, but it really boils down to three things. And the first thing is the casework. Trying to find and then resolve cases of apparent actual innocence. Mistakes are made in our criminal justice system more often than we would want to realize. DNA years ago informed us of that. And so we try to find those cases where a person is in prison, but they are actually and factually innocent. And the second component of the mission of the Illinois Innocence Project is education. And that involves students at the University of Illinois Springfield, students at the law school here in Champaign-Urbana, and public presentations and other components of the innocence part of the mission. And then the third thing is reform. And we work a lot with the legislature trying to, you know, propagate and ultimately ask them to pass laws which make the landscape that much more balanced and fair so that wrongful convictions are less likely to occur. Those three are the missions of the Illinois Innocence Project.
How does the Illinois Innocence Project go about vetting those, and how many requests come to the project? You know, I'm sure there's only so much capacity. How does that process work?
Well, your last point is really where any such discussions should start. There is only so much capacity. Fortunate, like other innocence organizations in the country, to have a good infrastructure, in our case of students and some volunteers who do a lot of the vetting of the research and the gathering of documents so you can give a meaningful analysis to every application. It's like a funnel. The cases start with students and volunteers and other staff, non-legal staff, reading the cases, making outlines, summaries of the cases, and then presenting those cases to the attorneys. And if the attorneys are particularly interested in a case, then then it goes that much further down the funnel for the gathering of additional documents, perhaps a phone call with the incarcerated person, perhaps a phone call with the family. It's information gathering at that point. So I wish that there was a huge amount of money and staff, because we think that there are sometimes cases that don't get the full attention that they deserve. But that's, I think, inherent in any social justice organization, that you can only do what you can do. In Springfield right now, I'm very part-time, and we have one other lawyer who is actually the director, and most of her responsibilities go toward management. In Chicago, we have two full-time lawyers and two part-time lawyers up there. That's it. So really, there's only two full-time lawyers whose duties are fully devoted to working on these cases. It's a lot of cases for just a handful of people.
Well, let's talk a little bit about one specific case. Heartland Community College is going to be a talk involving the case of Angel Gonzalez. So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about his specific situation, his case, and how did he come to be incarcerated?
You know, I'm a longtime criminal defense lawyer, and I learned of the innocence movement by reading a book called Actual Innocence by Barry Scheck and Peter Newfield and James Squire. And it was a cathartic, eye-opening experience for me. I had long had to deal with prosecutors who thought they were astride white horses and that mistakes were never made. And I'm reading this book and I'm going, oh my God, what I've thought all along. So I actually started teaching a course at the University of Illinois, an undergraduate course for freshmen called Actual Innocence, Defects in the American Criminal Justice System. And that, I think, part of the same mission of the Illinois Innocence Project, which I learned of its existence, you know, during this period of time, but I really had no context with it. And then in about 2010, John and others reached out to me to ask if I was interested in being a volunteer attorney to work on a specific case for the Illinois Innocence Project. And I've worked on that case and am still working on that case as of right now.
Yeah, Angel Gonzalez in 1994 was a young man who lived in Lake County, Illinois, Waukegan, way up north in Illinois. 18 years old, had been in the country for 2 years. His entire family had emigrated to the United States when he was 16. And when he got wrongly caught up in this case, he was just 18 and barely spoke English at that time. So what happened in that case was that a young woman, sadly, unfortunately, and brutally, was sexually assaulted. She reported that it was by two men, and she was then asked to do a procedure that's highly, I think just about all attorneys would agree, is highly unreliable. Angel Gonzalez was, even though his physical description did not match the physical description that the police had in terms of facial hair, and even though his car only very generally matched the car that her boyfriend described seeing leaving the area hours later, really. So in other words, they have very, very little evidence to point to Angel. But she then made what's called a show-up identification. That's the unreliable procedure that I referred to. Show-up means here's a woman. Now, imagine this, sadly. Here's a woman who's been brutally raped. And they put her just a few hours after she's been raped. She's in a police car. And that police car is kind of backed off into a corner with the lights off, waiting for another car to arrive, a police car with Angel Gonzalez in it. And they then take Angel and they put him in front of the lights on the police car where this young woman is sitting and turn on the lights. And just one person to look up while this woman is literally in tears, crying because of, you know, obviously. And then they ask her, is that the guy? Now, even the U.S. Supreme Court over 50 years ago said that show-ups are an unreliable method of identification, over 50 years ago. But they refused to say, well, you know, we don't want to do those anymore. We begin with that very unreliable identification. They then took him inside and police station, and two English-speaking detectives then eventually worked with this kid who barely spoke English and got a so-called confession from him. Now, Spanish-speaking young man with an English-written confession, that raises red flags, you know, obviously right from the start. But then the close examination of the so-called confession revealed facts that were inconsistent with the known facts and inconsistent with what the victim had indicated had happened to her. Yet, you know, in these bad crimes, and Steve, I'm sure, can talk about this sad, difficult, emotional cases, sometimes things like that don't matter. And what matters is they want to get somebody. And Angel was that somebody. He served 21 years. He lost his 20s and his 30s, those decades. He lost those years because of a wrongful conviction. And ultimately, in 2015, he was exonerated by DNA. DNA has played such a key role in opening people's eyes. And Angel is one of the, I want to say one of the fortunate ones, but he lost 21 years.
You mention all these inconsistencies. What was his representation like through the process? Sure, you know, it looks like he's being kind of railroaded, but then everyone is supposedly has legal representation. So where did the process let him down in the system down there?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a fair question, very logical question. I'm not going to take any shots at his lawyer because this is a different time. This is a time when there wasn't DNA. I mean, I remember lawyering in 1994 and thinking, oh, somebody made an eyewitness identification. Wow, that's pretty strong evidence. How do you attack that? Well, we know now how to attack that. We know now that those are highly suspect because people's powers of observation and memories and ability to be affected by the surrounding circumstance, you know, it's not very good.
In defense of Angel's trial lawyer, I don't know anything about that lawyer. And I have no idea about the caseload. If he was an appointed lawyer, I can tell you historically he had way too many cases, likely did not have enough time to prepare to the extent that private counsel that has much fewer cases could do. In my view, likely lacked the resources to do it. And then the other thing I want to talk about in this particular case, because it fits his genre. So it's a sexual assault case. It's very, very rare that a lawyer cross-examine a victim in a sexual assault case without a jury feeling sorry for that victim, feeling empathy for that victim, saying there's no reason for that victim to come forward who has been violated unless, in fact, she's telling the truth. She's not mistaken. My God, what a traumatic experience. She quickly made an eyewitness identification, et cetera. So you have to take that into account, I think, to understand how he could be convicted. Yet on top of that, this false confession, and it's a double-edged sword. Angel likely at the time, and only knowing what we knew at the time, had very little chance. And as a matter of fact, we often see that people plead guilty under those circumstances, even though they were not guilty, because their lawyer were telling them they're going to make you a deal, they're going to offer you so much time. And if you take it to trial, you're going to get three times that time or four times that time. So, you know, we see that kind of situation.
So I don't think it's fair to take a shot at the lawyer. He had a lawyer. The lawyer tried the case. There were no obvious dropping of the ball, so to speak. And so I don't want to really take a shot at him. I just want to say that the system has come a long way in terms of the ability to really truthfully examine an eyewitness identification and a confession. People didn't believe in false confessions. What's a false confession? Nobody says something inconsistent with their own interests. Well, again, DNA has proven that they do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that confession portion of it. Not all that long ago in Illinois, a bill was signed banning law enforcement from lying to persons under 18 during interrogations. And a lot of people say this is to solicit confessions because they're sort of implicit threats based upon evidence that doesn't exist. I know the Innocence Project was involved, or the Illinois Innocence Project was involved, in pushing some of the efforts for that legislation to go forward. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
In the situation with juveniles, very, very effective interrogation of juveniles who are scared to death, never been in this situation before, mentally immature, intellectually challenged, and to have the ploy, because I've seen it with, particularly with students here at the University of Illinois who get charged. I had one very infamous case where three different students were charged with the same crime, and the police take them all to the station at the same time, put them in three separate rooms, lie to each of them that the other two have told, you know, on you, you know, to get confessions from each of the three, that sort of thing. And so if you stop and think about that kind of ploy with a juvenile, it can be very effective and very much can lead to false confessions. And again, I think John will agree with me, this is not an attack on police or police tactics. What we're concerned about are the results of those police tactics, because innocent people get convicted. And that's our goal, is trying to stop, nip in the bud, wrongful convictions. And, you know, one of the ways to do that is to make sure that the process by which interrogations occur are fair.
I think it should start with the understanding that I think many people who are not lawyers don't have this understanding, and that is that police are permitted to lie during interrogations. And that takes people by surprise, I've found. They don't understand that. You know, we look at police in the situation of a very bad crime as Steve said, you know, riding in on the horse to save the day. But then we learn that police can lie about evidence and about your co-defendant in the other room kind of giving you up, or we found your DNA at the crime scene or a fingerprint or something along those lines, or you failed a polygraph, you know, those sorts of things that are not true. And the idea there is that, you know, those things are done because it works. It shakes loose people to say things. And sometimes those things are not truthful. And the reason that people, that suspects will say something is feeling coercion and pressure, wanting it to end. You know, an innocent person, as they're being interrogated, I think the most important thing to remember is they have the truth on their side. Again, just a normal person would say, you know, I didn't do this and I want this to end. These guys are in my face and I just want it to end. So I'll say whatever and it all gets straightened out later. Well, it doesn't until, in Angel's case, 21 years later. And so the idea is the juveniles are the most vulnerable to coercion and pressure and non-truths from police officers. And so good for our legislature for saying, you know what, we're going to draw the line in juvenile cases and not permit that. And frankly, the reaction to the bill from the public, you know, which learned that the Illinois Innocence Project was one of the driving forces behind the bill, the reaction has been, okay, great. Well, what about the rest of the cases that are not juvenile cases? You guys need to do something about that now. So the public reaction is actually, to me, very encouraging. They want more truth during the interrogation processes.
Another bit of legislation the Illinois Innocence Project has been involved in advocating for has to do with testimony that is solicited by people that are already incarcerated, so-called jailhouse snitches. And I wonder if either of you could talk a little bit about that and how that might be problematic. I think that most people outside of the criminal justice system learn everything about the criminal justice system from TV, from 1 million hours of Law and Order. We've seen all of these tactics that you're talking about performed by the heroes, and it's always perfectly acceptable. So I wonder if either of you could talk about the Illinois Innocence Project's advocacy to change the way that maybe this so-called jailhouse snitch process is applied.
What you have to picture is that there's a guy in jail and he wants to get out of jail. That's the driving force. That's his motivation. I want to get out of jail. And so being crafty, he tries to create a situation where the record shows he and my putative defendant here are in the same place at the same time. And then he will use that opportunity, if it's somehow documented, to reach out, perhaps through his lawyer, perhaps directly to jail personnel, but ultimately to the prosecutor, to say, I know something about John Jones' case. And so then he lets himself get interviewed, and he says that John Jones confessed to him. John Jones confessed that he actually did the sexual assault that he's accused of, even though he's been denying it. And then the prosecutor says, well, are you willing to come into court and testify that John Jones told you that he did it? And he says, sure. And so now he appears in court. He testifies that John Jones confessed to him at jail. It was a jailhouse confession. And the end result is that our Sam Smith snitch gets a break, gets his case resolved in a way much more favorable to him because he was a jailhouse informant. Unfortunately, that happened all the time. And the question of the credibility of Sam Smith snitch, was one for the jury, and only one for the jury. And the prosecutor got to decide who the witnesses were and when they wanted to present it. And there was no protection whatsoever. That is me representing John Jones that I could do.
So John, tell us a little bit about the legislation that addresses this issue.
Yeah, sure. So in 2017, I decided that this is a problem that I've been concerned about for a long time. Jailhouse snitch testimony was the leading cause of wrongful death row convictions when we had a death row in this state. And that, you know, a lot of those cases coming out of Cook County, it was more of the practice then that if a case had some holes in it, that a prosecutor was going to try to fill in the holes with a jailhouse snitch. And I'll say it again, because this is so important. The leading cause of death row wrongful convictions, 21 people, by the way, came off of death row in our state because they were innocent. And the leading reason for that by a plurality was the use of unreliable, lying jailhouse snitches. That's, you know, that's pretty disturbing. So there was a statute on the books for death penalty cases, but we got rid of the death penalty in the state in 2011. And our mission then became to take that statute. And, you know, if somebody goes to prison for 50 years or 60 years or, you know, pick a number, that's a significant sentence. So why should that law that kind of provided a hoop for prosecutors to jump through to use a snitch, why should that law not apply in those big number prison sentence cases? So we were able to achieve that by working with the legislature. The statute has several different components to it, but to me, the best part of the statute is that, you know, sometimes jailhouse snitches are repeat customers. You know, there are people who do this over and over and over again because they are in trouble over and over and over again. And so they, you know, provide, hey, I'll work with you if you work with me kind of thing. And so one of the components of the statute is, hey, if a jailhouse snitch has provided testimony in a prior case, the state has to disclose that to the defense. Otherwise, you're cross-examining the snitch in a vacuum. I think that's huge. And trial attorneys know how important it is to be able to cross-examine in context. If a guy has taken the stand in six cases to be used as an informant, shouldn't the jury know about that? Well, after this law, now they do. And the other key component of the statute is that the judge gets to hear the informant prior to the trial. And the judge gets to make a determination as to, you know, kind of baseline credibility. Like, you know, okay, this is kind of ridiculous. And this person, I'm not going to even let him hit the stand in this trial. That's essentially what the law is. And there's a couple of other components, but we're really proud of that. Then Governor Rauner vetoed the bill. And then we really had to go to work convincing enough legislators to override that veto. And that was successful. You know, it's funny. These things are just common sense. You know, a lot of these legislation and other things, it's just common sense. Let us know if this person has been a snitch before. Give us plenty of notice that you intend to use a snitch. Let the judge hear from the snitch. These are just common sense factors. So we're glad that got done.
So getting back a little bit to Angel Gonzalez and his situation, after 20 some years of him being incarcerated, the DNA evidence leads to his release from prison. As an individual, what happens to him then? He went away for over 20 years. What resources does he have coming out of prison? Does the state say, golly, we interrupted your entire life, so we are obligated to do something to make sure that you have a situation to go into with a 20-year gap in being able to make an income, in any of that sort of thing? What is the situation for this person that has been exonerated from the crime as they leave prison?
One thing that you pointed out quite accurately, Steve, is that the exoneree who's been in prison all that time is ill-equipped for the adjustment back into society. If you stop and think about it, take Angel, who while he was in prison, computers, social media, ATMs, the aspects of technology and society advance so much. Angel just didn't have a clue how to adjust, how to address it, how to respond to it. And I've helped with some of the other exonerees from the Illinois Innocence Project myself as a volunteer attorney to help them with legal advice and things like that. And I just see it. I see it repeatedly that they're not ready. They don't have somebody, oftentimes they don't even have a family member who is available to help them sort of navigate what society is like now. The other sad part of it, though, is you stop and think about it, like Angel would have met his spouse. He would have started a family. He would have a job and a career. He would have settled in, living our American dream, and that's all gone. That's all gone because of this wrongful conviction.
Steve is, right on in terms of that assessment without any question. And we at the Illinois Innocence Project found that to be universally true. Nobody walks out into, here you go, here's your job, here's your relationships, here's your pile of money, good luck. Sometimes these cases have to be looked at in multiple segments. And one of the biggest and most difficult segments is, you walk out of prison innocent today, what happens to you tomorrow? So there are two different legal paths that a person can attempt to file a claim to get some kind of, some kind of resources, money. The first is that if a judge signs off on what's called a certificate of innocence, if a judge, circuit court judge, signs off on that, then that is the magic piece of paper that you have to then go to the Illinois Court of Claims and you get some money dependent upon how long you were in. It's really not that much. I had one client who got, he was in for 18 years, exonerated, fully exonerated by DNA, and he got $230,000. That's about $11,000 a year. Not so good. So we've actually had a bill, which is pending right now. I don't think it's going to get action this term, but we've actually had a bill to increase that amount. And if a person gets the magic piece of paper saying you're officially, legally, thoroughly innocent, you got to get some amount that makes sense. And that doesn't make sense. The second way that you can potentially have a recovery is via a federal civil rights lawsuit. And I'll just say that those are, for the most part, few and far between, because the burden of proof, you have to prove that there is some really bad, non-negligent, non-careless, really intentional kind of bad conduct on the part of law enforcement. Those cases are tough. Most people come out and they get option A, the certificate of innocence, which is a state-based recovery. And most come out and don't have, just it's so hard to prove. Try to prove what happened 25 years ago. It's really, really difficult. So most do not have federal civil rights recoveries. Some do, but most don't. So that's their options. But then that's only part of the story is money. It's like, as Steve alluded to, how do you get a job? What do you do? Where have you been? Well, I was locked up for 21 years. Good luck getting someone to be trusting of that situation. I had one former client say he tried to start a home repair business, a very handy guy, could fix anything. And I said, how's it going? And he said, well, not so good. Well, how come? And he said one word, Google. He said, before I go into anybody's house to fix it, responsible people are going to check somebody out. They Google and they say, oh my God, this guy was convicted of a murder. And then you scroll down and it says he's exonerated and DNA and all that stuff. But once they see murder, they don't care about the rest. So it's hard, really hard for some people to get past this, even though the truth is that they had nothing to do with it.
Well, John and Steve, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today about the Illinois Innocence Project, about this Angel Gonzalez case and these larger issues. Look forward to hearing your talk at the event that Heartland Community College will be having here in a couple of weeks. And I appreciate you visiting with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Hanlon and Stephen Beckett work for the Illinois Innocence Project. They are part of the Heartland Community College Hawk Talks event held this spring. If you're interested in more interviews about criminal justice, history, and other compelling topics, subscribe to our Random Acts of Knowledge podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening.